Is the 8th day of May, and we're on Tuesday night here at Shari Tefillah learning Masechet Bava Kamma. We're in chapter 4, Mishnah 4, the same Mishnah we started last week. So we're going to read the Mishnah. So Vivian, you have right the Mishnah itself. I see you have there the photocopied.
This one?
Yeah. So let's go, and everyone else has it, of course. Let's go to the 4th chapter, the 4th Mishnah, and we will read. We have the place?
Yes.
Okay, so the Mishnah goes like this. I'm going to read about the first two lines. Shur shel fikeach, shenagach shur shel chiresh, shote v'katan chayav. Meaning an ox of a fikeach, meaning a normal person. Shenagach shur shel chiresh, shote v'katan. That gore the ox of a chiresh, of a deaf person, shote of an imbecile or retarded person, and a katan of a minor, chayav. In other words, I, and it's totally logical, my ox, gored the ox of someone else, have to pay, whatever it might be, chatzi nezek, nezek shalem, depending on the conditions. And it's pretty simple, of course. Mm-hmm. It goes without saying. It would be superfluous to say that, but it comes just as a contrast to what's going to be said afterwards, which is that, shel cheresh shote v'katan, shenagach shor shel fikeach, Pator. And of course, the half sentence just read, that phrase is missing a word at the beginning. It's shor, is word missing. Ox. The ox of, the sentence begins with of. It's assumed that it's ox of cheresh v'katan, of someone who is deaf or is an imbecile or is a minor. Shenagach shor shel fikeach. The ox of one of these three people. Gored, a normal person's ox. Pator. The cheresh shoteh, the katan, does not have to pay for the damage that was done. And we can stop there for a moment, because that sets down the major concepts of the Mishnah, and let's go over what we talked about last time, and then even add more concerning it. So we talked about the first four questions on the sheet, I believe, and here's a review. The first question says, what very basic legal principle seems to be assumed, not taught, but assumed, by the concept expressed by the phrase, and look exactly at the phrase that I brought in the sheet, nothing more, nothing less, shur shel cheresh shoteh v'katan, without a verb. Just that statement, the ox of a cheresh shoteh v'katan, what legal principle is assumed by that statement, without a verb?
That they can own, right?
And you might have said to yourself, wait a second, I'm not sure about that. Why can they own things? A katan, a minor, he can own things? To own it means you have to acquire it somehow. Mm-hmm. How did he acquire it? Was it through inheritance? Did he get a gift? Did he buy? Can he do all those things? Can he inherit? Can he buy? Can he accept gifts? And if he can, as apparently he can, because it says he owns the ox, it also means probably that he can give a gift and also sell. But does that make so much sense that a katan can do those things? That a shote, someone who really doesn't have the intellectual capacity, how can the law recognize his transaction? So we have a big question here. And that's, of course, question two. What difficulty might one find in the above-mentioned legal principle? As we just said, number three, what would seem to be the very specific social legal situation that kind of... Sometimes I talk too fast. Of the katan in this Mishnah.
Orphan.
He probably is an orphan. Because it doesn't make sense to talk about him owning an ox. Probably, if he has a father, his father owned the ox. He wouldn't own anything. Mm-hmm. So it might just be talking about a orphan. In Hebrew, a yitom.
Or he's deserted.
Or, right, it could be that he has parents, but effectively they're not functioning as his parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't say...
It doesn't say orphan. Right.
I was going to say, and you know, we normally think that a minor can't contract, but a minor can buy. In other words, a minor can't contract to pay something out, but if the minor has the money, the minor can buy it.
They all the time buy ice cream.
That's right.
Right, yeah. So Tom is pointing out that it might not be a simple yes or no. Can a katan, is he considered to be a responsible legal entity for buying and selling? The answer might be gray, not black or white, but the answer might be some things yes, some things no. And we'll see that in another few minutes. Mm-hmm. Question four. Looking at the first part of the Mishnah.
Can a minor today buy a house?
I think they they can't contract
the minor. They can't contract.
But if they had the kind of money, they could buy it.
The younger stars will buy houses for their parents, right? Mm-hmm. Or not even necessarily for their parents. Mm-hmm. They definitely are buying things mm-hmm. and houses. And
what formal or structural similarity do you see to the second half of the previous Mishnah? Of course, that the Timmins can't get because they weren't here. But mm-hmm. we said that the previous Mishnah talks about a paradox of the same structural type as an our Mishnah, that there's a lack of symmetry, right?
Oh, we did talk about that.
Oh, you were here for the first class. We spent three classes on that.
That's right, okay. Yeah. I believe it. Yeah, it was
so this, okay.
Because well, it's obviously a problem.
You were traipsing in Israel.
We were sweating over the issues. Okay, so we saw the previous Mishnah.
We were looking at those oxen that they were talking about. Did you see any oxen when you were in
Israel? We were struggling with all the uphills in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
But did you see any
So the end of the previous Mishnah, we saw that a shor belonging to a Yisrael that gores the ox of a Nochri is Patur, but the opposite way around, the ox of a Nochri, of a non-Jew that gores the ox of a Yisrael, has to pay, and even has mm-hmm. to pay perhaps more than is normally accepted. Mm-hmm.
So
and
I
our
don't
Mishnah
understand why you're saying this doesn't make sense to you. If a retarded person has an ox and it gets gored by my ox, I have to pay.
That makes sense.
And if a retarded person has an ox and it gores my ox, he doesn't have to pay.
Right. Why?
Because he's retarded.
He's not capable of controlling the ox.
So first of all, that's not what I said is hard to understand.
That's not what he's saying.
What's hard to understand is, are these people legal entities at all?
Well, it doesn't
matter. Do they have the capacity
to
own
them? And they, you know, they're here. I mean,
well, the assumption has to be, because this talks about them having this ox, that mm-hmm. they must be
yes.
able to be the legal entity.
But how could that be? How can a katan, or how can a shoteh?
Have you ever had a conversation with a retarded person? I mean,
no.
It's not about a conversation.
No, I was going to say, the person could have been sane when they acquired the ox.
Oh, we'll also get to that. How did you know we're going to get to all these things? Because you're a lawyer.
Well,
that is very
they may not have been deaf at the time that they acquired it.
But Mary Beth is still disturbed by what she's bringing up. So I'm just saying.
I'm not disturbed. I'm just saying you keep saying it doesn't balance. It doesn't balance. It seems to me that one thing happens and this person is blameless, and then the other thing happens and the same person is blameless.
Okay, I'm not, again, there's the what I call the tension of the paradox. Let's call it lack of symmetry.
Yeah,
in the Mishnah, that's one point.
To me. I'm sorry, it seems very symmetrical.
But that's not what I'm referring to. I'm referring to the very question of can a shoteh be considered at all a legal entity? There has to be a certain degree of responsibility and of understanding.
But wait, you're talking about two different things. You're talking about symmetry and
right.
Legal
that's the point. It's two different things.
Where's the symmetry? I want to go back to the symmetry. You're saying it's not symmetric, and I'm saying it is.
No, you can't say it's symmetrical because it's not. Mm. You can say you understand the lack of symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
But she's saying there is no lack of symmetry. It's perfectly symmetrical.
And but she's wrong.
What's not symmetrical? Explain to me what's not symmetrical.
It seems like if it were symmetrical, then the same rules would apply to both sides.
Exactly.
Right. They would either both be chayav or patur.
So within themselves,
it's like within a chui and the Jew.
It's like there's two different standards here. This group of people are chayav, they're held to one standard, and this other group
of people are patur, they're held to a different standard.
Okay, so when you're saying symmetrical, you're saying
each incident is not symmetrical.
Right, right.
Okay, I thought you were saying that incident A is not symmetrical with incident B. That was my misunderstanding.
What is A and what is B?
A is my ox scores the retarded person's ox.
Yeah.
B is the retarded person's ox scores.
You're right. That's A and that's B. And A and B are not symmetrical.
They're not
How
symmetrical.
Are they not symmetrical?
Mary
because
Beth,
one
wait a second.
And the other one doesn't
Not symmetrical.
The consequences
Mary
are
Beth,
different.
When I say something that's not symmetrical, that's not a value judgment.
Well, no. I'm seeing it as like colors and scales and stuff. I don't see any value.
Not symmetrical simply means they're not equivalent. They're not equal. That's all it means. It might be perfectly understandable that they're not symmetrical, but they're not symmetrical.
Okay.
Symmetry simply is about a balance, about things being the both and same
quality. To me, I'm sorry, but we can go on.
Okay.
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 So now,
Well, you understand that one has to pay and the other one doesn't have
to
pay.
Yeah, yeah, they're saying it's a village to me.
I don't want to discuss
different.
It anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. Nobody's going to consult me about this Mishnah question.
Okay, so now, in order to understand what's going on in this Mishnah, we're going to see some other sources. Some of them we saw last week, and we're reviewing. Some are new. And we're going to go da-da-da-da-da, go through these interesting sources. And here we begin. In Hebrew, in the second half of the page, first it's Mishnah Masechet Trumot. And all we find there is the following. Chirish HaMedaber Veino Shomea. A deaf person who speaks and doesn't hear, Lo Yitrom. He doesn't do the legal act of Toreim, of Truma, which means to separate from normal everyday food, to separate a part that's going to be given to the Kohanim. Mm-hmm. And to separate means that that part becomes legally Truma, becomes legally holy, and has new laws. And the Cheresh doesn't have the authority to make that legal statement that changes the status of the food. However, the Mishnah goes on to say, Vim Taram Chumato Chuma. If he did it, his doing is done. Right? If he made the Chuma is Chuma, which means he legally does have the power to affect the change, but rather the rabbi said he shouldn't do it. But if he did it, it's done.
What
it has legal authority.
The change?
What is the shit to change?
Yeah.
The change is very simple. Here I have food. I have a pound of carrots. And I'm a non-Kohen. I'm allowed to eat those carrots. If the owner of the food comes and says that particular part of the bundle of carrots belongs now to the Kohenim, it's Chuma, then that part of the carrot bundle legally, it's a new change in status. It becomes Truma, which means it becomes Kodesh, which means that if a non-Kohen eats it, he's doing something that's forbidden. The Cheresh that can speak but can hear should not make that change in the food. But if he does,
it's accepted.
It's accepted, it's done. And then the non-Kohen cannot eat from the food that's been designated as Truma. But then this Mishnah goes on to say, Cheresh shedibru bo hachamim, the cheresh that talked about him, the sages, b'chol makom, in every place, sheino shomea velo medaber, is one that doesn't hear and also doesn't speak. And the implication is
that he cannot.
That he, the one who can't speak and can't hear, if he did this act, not only should he not do it, but if he did it, it doesn't have any legal standing at all. That's the implication.
Is it that anyone can decide what's holy and what's not holy among the bunch?
The owner can decide.
The owner, just arbitrarily?
Well, there are certain laws. How much he has to designate as Truma.
Oh, there's always that you have to do that?
Yeah, it's a mitzvah Torah. You have to do it.
Oh,
for all agricultural produce.
Okay.
You have to do it, but until you do it, it's not done.
Okay.
But only in Eretz Yisrael, no?
That's true.
That's true.
That's only true. That's true. So the implication, for what we learn here from our Mishnah, the implication is twofold.
And all that.
But the implication is going to be that, number one, the Cheresh, who's discussed in our Mishnah, is going to be the Cheresh that Eino Medaber, Beino Shemea, the one that can't speak and can't hear. That's the Cheresh in our Mishnah. When our Mishnah puts the Cheresh in a special category, it's not talking about a deaf person, it's talking about a mute person. Deaf-mute.
Mm-hmm.
That's point number one in our Mishnah, from the Mishnah here in Masechet Shumot. And the second point we learn from Masechet Shumot is that this type of cherish doesn't seem to have the legal authority to make transactions, to change the status of something. I would think that if he can't change the status of chulin to truma, of normal food to truma, that probably means he doesn't have the legal authority to change the ownership of property, right? Just like he can't take the property and make it of the Kohenim, so he can't take probably his own property and make it mine. It means probably that he can't buy and he can't sell. If he can't make chulin into truma, then he probably can't buy and can't sell, probably.
So it's more important to be able to speak than to be able to...
The implication is that somebody can't speak, he doesn't have dot, doesn't have understanding. of the situation. Whereas a deaf person can be perfectly in control of the situation and understand.
Can read.
Well, a person who can't hear can read.
Is that what you said?
There are other ways for that person to get in information. They could read lips, they could read sign language, they could read text so they can absorb information and process it.
And if they
can speak, then you assume that they... Then this type of text is ascribing to them a certain level of mental competence.
I once showed a deaf person that spoke six languages, the deaf girl.
Wow.
But I want to remind everyone
understandably
that in a oral culture like the Mishnah, where there's very little reading and very little writing and everything is spoken, mm-hmm. in a culture like that, it is oftentimes the case that a deaf person becomes a deaf mute person.
Because
they can't hear.
And that's why the word for cheresh, which really means deaf, the Mishnah says usually means deaf mute, because that's the case. Right. Usually a deaf person does not learn how to take part in society at all, in that society, in an oral society. Our society is different.
It's interesting that we deal with cheresh and not with iver.
Blind.
Oh.
Because blind people, okay, they can't read, but in oral society, if they can hear, they're part of society.
Mm-hmm. But how does a blind person
control
his ox?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't know.
It's sign language.
Okay, so let's go on.
What's the worst one now? The not speaking. Deaf.
And the word cheresh, which means deaf, legally means deaf mute. That's what the text just said. Unless stated otherwise, when it says cheresh, it means deaf mute, and that's the person that our Mishnah in the Sefer Baba Kama is talking about.
But it said if they can hear, then...
If they can speak and not hear, that's a rare case.
Yeah.
That's a rare case.
And it's a sign of high intelligence.
So let's see about that right now. This Talmud Bavli Masechet Chagigah, Tractate Chagigah, the second source. Chutz mi cheresh shoteh v'katan. There's a Mishnah there that says a certain halakha applies to everyone but chutz mi, with the exception of, cheresh shoteh v'katan. And you don't even have to know what the context is. Because the truth is, there are many Mishnayot that say that law X applies to everyone but cheresh shoteh v'katan. What does the Gemara say about this? It says, katani cheresh dumya deshoteh v'katan. Translation, it taught us cheresh similar to shoteh and katan. There's the fact that they're in the same category must mean they have the same characteristics. Ma shoteh v'katan v'lav b'nei de'a. What shoteh v'katan, they're not b'nei de'a. They're not literally children of understanding. They have no mental competence. Av cheresh, so cheresh, delav bar deah hu. So with a cheresh, next line, that he's not a child of competence. In other words, he's not a person of competence. Kamashmalan kiditanan. It comes to teach us, as we learned in a Mishnah, cheresh dibru bo hachamim bechol makom. And now it's quoting the Mishnah from Masechet Shumat that we saw, that a cheresh that talked about him, the hachamim, in all places, sheino shomea veino medaber. It's one who doesn't hear and doesn't speak. In other words, he's just like a katan and a shoteh. He doesn't have mental capacity. Ha medaber veino shomea. Behold, if he speaks but doesn't hear, shomea veino medaber, or hear and doesn't speak, hayav. He's obligated in all mitzvot. He's just like everyone else. If he has one but not the other, it's only when he's missing both, the speaking and the hearing, that we say about him that he's like a katan and like a shoteh, that he's not bar dat, that he's not mentally competent, and many laws therefore don't apply to him, and many and legal authority for selling and buying doesn't apply to him. Tanina laha de tanu rabbanan. We learned in a braita just like we learned in the Mishnah. Middle of the third line. Hamidaber v'ino shamea zeu cheresh. He who speaks and doesn't hear, that's the cheresh. Wait a second. Shomea v'ino medaber zeu ilem. If he hears and doesn't speak, he's a ilem, which means mute. Ze v'ze harei elu kipichin l'chol divrehem. If he can do both of them, ze v'ze. I said it wrong.
No.
This one and that one, the one that can hear but can't speak, the one that can speak and not hear, they're like pikhin l'chol divrehem. They're like normal people in all their legal statuses. Who's different? The one who can't do it and can't do it. Who can't hear and can't speak. Mm-hmm. Right? So we're repeating ourselves many times. I'm just showing you that a number of different sources have the same halakha, and then the last line in the quarter says, v'hachi katani, thusly we learned, hakol chayvin b'riya v'simcha, all are obligated in the mitzvot of seeing and being seen.
That's the aliyah.
That's riya. And of simcha, of happiness. These are both on the regel, on the pilgrimage festival. Chutz mi'cheresh shoteva katan. Except for those three. Ho'il ufiturin mikol mitzvot. Since they're exempt from all the mitzvot amarot b'Torah, they're spoken in the Torah. In other words, these three people, Cheresh, Shoteh, V'Katan, are exempt from all the mitzvot in the Torah.
Including the Shabbat, including everything.
All positive mitzvot. Positive. Mm-hmm. Not negative mitzvot, all positive mitzvot they're exempt from. And like we learned, also it looks like we're being told they can't be involved in legal transactions. So it seems from this point. Right. Now, you all knew this about Katan. Everyone knows that Katan is exempt from all the mitzvot. But it's true also for Shoteh.
We saw this in Tractate Sukkah.
Yes.
And in terms of the obligation to...
Remember, Shammai had the grandson.
Shabbat, we have positive aspects to remember and to keep. But we have negative aspects of things you don't do.
Right.
So they're responsible for the... They may not remember or keep, but they're responsible to not do the things that are forbidden.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But
so Shabbat's real complex.
This trip of yours has done such good things to you.
Yeah, boy, it's really kind of gotten
sparkling. It's this Jerusalem traipsing.
Wait a second. I knew that was true when I said it, but now I'm not sure. Wait a second. You know what?
Is it positive and negative?
I'm confused. I confused myself. I have mental luck. Mm-hmm.
Well, I just got to thinking about it. You know, isn't it a regular commandment to both? I guess, I don't know if it's one or two, to keep and to remember.
Right.
But we're also told not to do certain things.
Shemirat Shabbat is one mitzvah or a few mitzvot?
Wait a second. There's Zachor and there's Shamor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's it? And Lo Ta'asu Kol Melacha is not a third?
There's lots of mitzvot. I mean, there's two categories, right? Positive and negative.
Yeah.
There's lots of mitzvot. And there's lots of isurim and lots of prohibitions. But what I just said, that these three human beings are obligated in the negatives, I take that back. I now don't remember. I'll probably remember what I had in mind as soon as the class is over.
Of course.
Well, I have to make a comment about something that just recently happened on this hearing and speaking deal. Because a woman I work with, her father unfortunately fell very badly on the sidewalk, and he's currently in the hospital. And it was so bad they gave him a trach, and then they had the feeding tube. And they said, okay, currently he can make no decisions, so someone has to get power of attorney. So in the process, they're from Minneapolis, and he just happened to be here visiting his daughter when this happened. So with the trach, of course, he cannot speak, and he's right now just relearning how to swallow. However, he's come to his senses, and he can now write. So now they said, you don't need power of attorney. He's very capable of making legally every single decision you want because he is able to write even though he cannot speak.
So
I just thought it was interesting.
But he can hear.
He can hear.
One of those two.
Right. I just thought it was interesting. It just so happened that he cannot speak. And on the basis of him being able to write back or even showing response with his eyes and grabbing hands, they decided he's perfectly legally competent and he needs no power of attorney and nobody else can make decisions for him and the hospital will take whatever
he says, meaning
writing or communicating in some way. But I just thought it was so interesting
because
he absolutely cannot. He's currently in the situation of hearing and not being able to speak. And the doctor telling her, which was, I thought, the worst yet, is that he told her that, you know, it'll be a luxury if he can speak again. But we do think he probably will be able to, but at the moment that...
Okay, we're going to see now some more sources going on with the background to understanding our Mishnah in Bava Kamma. The next source is from the Talmud Bavli, Masechet Bava Metzia. And it's a Mishnah. And the Mishnah says as follows. Mishnah. Mitziat Beno Uvito Haktanim. Concerning the fines of his son and his daughter who are ketanim. Fines. They find things in the street. Mitziat Avdo Ushifchato Haktanim. Or the fines of his male or female Canaanite slaves. Non-Jewish slaves. Mitziat Ishto. Also concerning the fines of his wife. Hare Elu Shelo. Behold, these are his. In other words, they don't belong to the son, not to the daughter, not to the slave, not to the female slave, not to the wife. They all belong to the master of the house. Mitziat, well, let's go on and see what that means. Mitziat beno uvito hagdolim, the fines of his son and his daughter who are
grown,
gedolim, who are big. Mitziat avdo v'shifchato ivriim, or the fines of his slave or his female slave who are ivriim, who are Hebrew, who are Jewish. Mitziat ishto shegirsha, the fine of his wife who he divorced her. Afa pisha lo natan ketubah, even though he didn't give her a ketubah. Hare'elu shelahen, these belong to them, not to the man, but to the person who found them.
I'm not clear. Why ketubah not get?
Because if there wasn't get, then she's not divorced. Then the mitziah is really his.
But it's not shalonatan la get.
That's the point.
Shalonatan la ketubah. How would he give her ketubah when he divorces her?
Ketubah means her settlement.
The contract. The contract.
Even though he didn't give her a settlement yet, she's still divorced. So then she's an independent entity.
Gotcha.
Don't think that divorce is not finalized just because he didn't fulfill the conditions of giving her a settlement. If the divorce was made legally, then they're divorced. And he knows her money.
Yeah.
Does gidolim mean adult?
Yes.
Or just big?
It means big, but in this context it means adult. So we have to understand what we just read. And we're going to use the Gemara to understand it. Here we go.
Okay.
The Gemara on that Mishnah, it's the next source, the second source from the bottom, says, Ufligi de Rebbi Chiya bar Abba. Damar Rebbi Chiya bar Abba mar Rabbi Yochanan. And there's an argument of Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, as said Rabbi Chiya bar Abba in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. Quote. So what we're going to read is said by Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, but the Gemara tells us someone else argues. So it's not the only way of looking at it, but it's a possible way of looking at it. And what these rabbis said is, Lo gadol gadol mamash. It's don't understand that the gadol is a gadol mamash. Don't understand that the adult we talked about is really an adult. Velo katan katan mamash. And don't understand that the katan we talked about is really a minor. No. It really means something different than what you think it means. Ela gadol v'samuch al shulchan aviv. Zeo katan. Rather, someone who's a gadol, but he depends on the sustenance of his father, he's called a katan. Katan beino samucha shulchan aviv zeh gadol, and a katan who doesn't depend on the sustenance of his father, he's called a gadol.
So the provider independence here.
Just let me say. So what it seems to be saying is that what we learned in the Mishnah about the fines of the katan really doesn't depend on his technical legal status in a theoretical sense. It doesn't depend on his age.
It doesn't depend on his age.
It depends on a social contract.
Independence or dependence.
Which is a social contract.
It's an economical decision, okay. Isn't okay. It?
Yeah. So, which means it's very similar to the case of the wife.
Yes.
It's not a matter of what we talk about usually, cheresh shoteh v'katan, an independent theoretical legal status. Rather, it's a matter of a social contract that's been created either between the wife and her husband, mm-hmm. or in this case, between the son and the father. That means that, just let me finish. If okay. when we're saying here that the katan, the minor, whose fines belong to his father, and the gadol, whose fines don't belong to his father but rather to him, it's not because the katan legally cannot own or make transactions. It's for a different reason. It's because there's a social contract between him and his father. As long as he, not because he's a minor, mm-hmm. this could be true even if he's 80 years old. If he says, and they live as if all his sustenance comes from his father, then he's become part of his father's unit, and his father gets his fines. Not because the kid is not a legal entity. He is, but he's made an agreement to give it to his father. And so the opposite. If the kid is not a legal entity, he's a katan, but he doesn't live on his father's sustenance, then his father doesn't get his mitziot. Doesn't get
like
his fines.
Like a kibbutz.
It becomes, mm-hmm. okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But if, like that's, the distinction,
yes.
it seems like all servants would be in the same position, whether they're degree or the
okay,
Canaanite.
Because the Hebrew slave has not made such a social contract. He's an independent entity, and it can't change. Unless, of course, he'd want to, marry the Balabite.
Yeah, okay.
So what that means really is that for our purposes of trying to understand what's the legal status of a katan, we should ignore the Mishnah about the fines. Because that's really a statement not about his legal status, rather about the social contract he's entered into.
I thought there's no Eved Knani, that every slave that goes to work for a Jew has to
become a partial Jew.
Yes.
But a partial Jew is an Eved Knani.
Ah.
If he becomes a full Jew, then he's an Eved Ivri.
Gotcha.
A partial Jew, by the way, is someone who's obligated in the negatives, but not in the positives.
Like the Choresh Shoteh V'Katan.
Don't say that, because I backtracked and said I want to remain agnostic, because I have this mental block. Let's not perpetuate my potential mistakes.
I do have a spelling question. Shoteh to mean to drink. How do you spell that?
No, Shoteh to drink is with taf.
With a taf.
And
okay.
Shoteh, this okay. is with
the
okay.
taf.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Although there's a source that says the Shoteh with a taf mm-hmm. has the same status as a Shoteh with a
taf. That's what I was wondering.
If he drinks as much as, what does the source say? If he drinks as much as Lot.
Ah.
That's what the source says. It says if he gets as drunk as Lot, then the Shoteh has the status of a Shoteh. That's pretty drunk.
That's pretty drunk.
Yeah, that's
okay,
pretty
one more source on this page that we want to see says the following. It's from a Sechet Gittin. Matnitin, which means a Mishnah. Mm-hmm. These the last two lines of the page. Elud varim amru bifnei darkei shalom. These things were said because of the ways of peace. The ways of peace are rabbinic ordinances to further the proper functioning of society. And there's a long list of things that the rabbis instituted, and here is one of them. You see three dots? I skipped many things. Mitziat cheresh shoteh v'katan yesh behem mishum gezel mipnei darkei shalom. The find of a cheresh shoteh or katan, there is in them the matter of gezel, of thievery. because of Darkei Shalom, the ways of peace. Now what that means is the following, that anyone who steals from a Cheresh Shoteh V'Katan is considered to be a thief.
That's not what the Pasuk says. It says that their find is a gezel.
Right. What that means is when they find something, mm-hmm. and you steal it from them, you're considered to be a thief. When it says mishum gezel, it means the category of gezel applies to what they own.
But if you steal something from somebody else, isn't it a gezel?
Of course. Why does this Mishnah have to say that the rabbis instituted because of the ways of peace, that if you steal from a katan, it's considered to be stealing? Because had the rabbis not instituted it,
you could have assumed that, well, the katan can't own anything, so he doesn't have it anyway, so therefore
you can take
not
it.
Stealing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. This Mishnah is telling us that according to the letter of the law, a katan doesn't own what he finds, and therefore you can come and steal it from him, and it's not stealing, because he's not there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like it's lying on the floor. But the rabbi said, we don't want grown men stealing from little babies. It doesn't develop proper character traits, right? Therefore, we're going to say it's a special legal, extra legal category. You're not allowed to steal from them. Not because they really own it, but because of we want to create peace and harmony within society. Rabbi Yossi, in the last five words, Rabbi Yossi Omer Gezel Gamor. Rabbi Yossi says real thievery. According to Rabbi Yossi, the katan
can own.
Really does own things. And therefore, if you steal it, you're really a thief, and you don't need a rabbinic ordinance to make you into a thief. But that's only Rabbi Yossi. The halakha seems to be that the cheresh shoteh, the katan, all three of them, they don't have any legal ownership.
So that conflicts with our Mishnah.
It does. Yes. So hold on. Well, you know what? Since you just said it, then we will answer. When don't they have legal ownership? When they find things.
Ah. But they can inherit.
That implies, perhaps, that it's only when they find things they don't have legal ownership, mm-hmm. but they can perhaps gain legal ownership in other fashions. That brings us back to what Tom said a few minutes ago, that there might be different levels of legal status. Perhaps the katan, the chershuteh, the katan, can own in a certain fashion, but not in another fashion. Perhaps they can buy, but they can't sell. We'll see. But it's certainly clear that the chershuteh katan sometimes doesn't have legal ownership, and sometimes does, and they're not obligated any of the mitzvot, and they can't do the act of truma, as we saw. Let's go on now and get more information. Here I brought a source that I didn't have last week. The source we saw until now, we saw last week. Here's a new one.
But in truma, we have only cheresh.
You're right.
Do we have shoten katan too?
I'm assuming that's the same. Perhaps it won't be. We'll see. The next source says, in the Talmud Bavli, Masechet Yevamot, it says, Dabar. The first word is not Dabar. It's not a Hebrew word. Ah. It's rather two Aramaic words, Dibar. And the word bar, of course, means Ben.
Ben?
A son or an owner.
Yeah, Bar Kochva.
Right? Dibar Shatya. The word Shatya is the Aramaic form of the word Shoteh.
Mm-hmm.
A Bar Shatya is a Shoteh. Someone who's in possession of the quality of stupidity. Of imbecile likeness. And dibar shatya means of a bar shatya, zavin nichse.
Bar shatya is not the son of a shoteh?
No, it means someone who has the quality of being a shoteh. Dibar shatya, zavin nichse. Of a imbecile, zavin nichse. He can sell his possessions. Zavin, right? As Ilana just said, we know the word Zavin from Had Gadyan Haggadah. Zavin means, it's the root that means to buy and sell.
Buy and sell. In this case, it's just sell.
So in this case, it's not a legal statement, it's a description of what happened. A bar shatya went and he sold his possessions.
Oh.
It's telling you what happened.
Okay.
And then it says, Atu Beit Rei V'Amrei Kshehu Halim Zavin came around to Atu Beit Rei, came in or came around to, in other words, two witnesses, V'Amri, and said, Kshehu Halim Zavin. When he was sober, is a better word? When he was lucid, Zavin. When he was lucid, he sold. In other words, this person is known to be crazy. But these two witnesses said, I'm certain he was lucid when he sold. And their testimony comes to uphold the sale. V'atu Beit Rei, and came around to, meaning witnesses, V'amru, and they said, Kshehu Shote Zavin. They said, when he was crazy, he sold. In other words, there are two witnesses that say the transaction stands because he was lucid, and two witnesses, no, the transaction does not stand because he was crazy when he sold.
Where does it say the word witnesses in here?
It doesn't.
Oh, okay.
It's assumed.
Okay.
So it just says two. And two is witnesses because you need two witnesses.
Trey. Oh,
Trey. And this is really like the case that you described in the hospital. It's not clear if the guy was mentally competent or not when he did what he did. And you need to prove what he was. And a lot writes in it. The question is, was the sale legally valid? So anyway, this source tells us two things. It tells that a shote, sales, are not legally valid. But it also tells you there's a category of person who goes back and forth between lucidity and stupidity.
Mm-hmm.
Better word, find me a more politically correct word, I'll use it.
Yeah. Kind of episodes.
Yeah. Lucid and not lucid.
Lucid and not lucid. Here's a lawyer for you.
Is this the bipolar?
Could be. Mm-hmm. So this another source that seems to confirm that a shote doesn't have the legal authority to make transactions. But let's go on and see more. And I brought one here that is very familiar
from
Masechet Sukkah. I don't know if we did it when we learned Sukkah last year, but it's very familiar to those who learn Masechet Sukkah and deal with the intricacies of the mitzvah of Arbat Aminim, of the four species, because it comes up halacha lemaaseh, practically speaking, every year. Amar Rabbi Zera, said Rabbi Zera, Lo likni inish hoshana lianuka biyoma tava kama. Translation from Aramaic to English. Lo likni inish. No, you shouldn't. Likni, don't buy. Inish, a man, right? A man shouldn't buy. Hoshana. Hoshana is a branch of one of the four species, the arava, the willow. And it really refers to all of the four species. We're just calling it a Hoshana. So a man shouldn't buy a lulav. Let's use the word lulav. Lianuka. From a yanuka. Yanuka is a child.
Not from, to.
I knew you'd say that. It's Aramaic.
Okay.
Le is from?
Oh, no, you're right, actually. I'm sorry.
So it shouldn't buy, it shouldn't sell.
Right, I'm sorry. You shouldn't sell a lulav to a child biyoma tava kama on the Yom Tov first, on the first day of Yom Tov. In other words, the first day of Sukkot, you shouldn't sell a lulav to a child. Thank you for the correction. My tama, what's the reason? The Yanuka Makne kane, aknuye lo makne. Translation, that a child buys, he bought. To sell, it's not sold. I'll say it again. That a child buys, he buys. That he sells, it's not sold.
Now who sells?
The child.
You sell two.
But it says inishkana, inish.
I'll explain.
Okay.
In the third word of the second line, veshtakach dekanafek belulav sheino shelo. And it turns out, eshtakach means it comes out, it turns out. Dekanafek. Nafek means to be yotze. He does the mitzvah. Belulav sheino shelo. With a lulav that's not his. You don't understand yet? Now read Rashi. Rashi says, Lo likni inish hoshana liyanuka. A man shouldn't sell his lulav to a child.
Bye.
Shouldn't sell.
Likni?
Yeah.
Is sell?
It's to be makne. To,
from kinyan.
To make a kinyan for to a child. Look what Rashi says. Bimatana, as a gift. Ad shelo yatsa bohu, until he doesn't fulfill his mitzvah with it.
Ah, so it's like the giving, that you do it and then you give to the next.
Exactly. So now let me explain. The assumption is, as we all know from last year, that on the first day of Sukkot, as opposed to the rest of the days, on the first day of Sukkot, to fulfill the mitzvah of lulav, as Ilana just said, you have to own the lulav. It can't be a borrowed lulav. It has to be owned by you, because the Torah says it has to be yours. V'lakachtem lechem, take for yourselves. It has to be yours. The second assumption is that in many, many places they didn't have many lulavim, and they had to use one for the whole congregation. How do you do that? You sell it as a gift to your fellow. Ah, you think I'm contradicting myself. I'm using the legal term sell, that is, you make a transaction, but the transaction is without money. You give it to your fellow, you sell it to him for nothing, and it becomes his. Mm-hmm. He does the mitzvah, and then he sells it to the next person for nothing.
Can you sell in a holiday?
Very good question.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You can't exchange money.
You can't exchange money. Yeah.
So it's, you sell it for nothing.
You
sell it
for nothing. For it the next day.
Right. So
can you
now,
promise money? Can you promise money?
I don't know. But let's stay to the point. Anyway, the custom is you sell it for nothing. You give it as a gift. But a gift is a legal transaction in which it's being acquired by the next person.
Ownership.
You transfer ownership. So now, what did the Gemara say? The Gemara said you shouldn't transfer ownership of a lulav to a katan on the first day of Sukkot. Why? Well, the Gemara said because the katan, when he acquires, it's acquired. But when he sells, it's not sold.
Oh, so he can't pass it on.
He can't pass it on.
He can buy it, but he can't sell it. He could acquire it, but he can't give it on to someone else. That's what the Gemara says. So the Gemara seems to be doing what Tom said earlier. It might be the case that there are different levels of legal authority as far as transactions go. The katan, for some reason, can buy even without money,
mm-hmm.
but he can't sell.
Is this the only place where it says that, or is it general?
There's one other source that says this, but mm-hmm. that is basically going to be the halakha. Now, let's try and think why that might be the case.
Because people will swindle.
Well, yeah.
No, it's not a social reason, it's a legal reason.
I mean, if he could make a contract to give some piece of property away, I mean, one of the first things that occurs to me is, does he even have ownership of that property to give it away?
In other words, if he buys it, does it belong to his...
Does it belong to his father?
But if he's an orphan?
Is it like
again, the father fine. Stuff, that was only a social contract.
But what happened... Let's take the situation of there is some household item. That kid better not go selling it.
But let me do this in legal terms. Okay. I'm going to put on the board here something as I take out my markers.
Mm-hmm.
In a transaction, in a transfer of ownership, there's the
buyer and the seller.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the transaction requires a buyer buying and a seller selling.
But the seller has to have provenance. The seller has to have actual
Of course,
ownership.
Absolutely. But we can ask ourselves the following question. In a transaction in which ownership is transferred with a buyer and a seller, you might think that both the buyer and the seller have equal input into the transaction. Okay, possible. But let's say that I'm going to suggest that they don't have equal input. Which one of them you think has more control of the situation?
The buyer.
The seller.
Yeah.
Some say the buyer, some say the seller.
Is it a buyer's market or a seller's market?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well,
so let's think about this. So I'm actually...
Yeah. The seller has complete control of it. Because he doesn't have to sell.
He doesn't have to sell.
He's got the thing, and if he doesn't give it up, he doesn't give it up.
But a seller can be, if a seller is in a difficult position, a seller can be manipulated
right.
to,
mm-hmm.
to sell at,
or buy a house.
At for less than reasonable, or to sell something that he really shouldn't. I mean, it depends on what's the situation that the seller
okay,
is in.
So mm-hmm. now let's take this issue. Who has more clout, the buyer or the seller? And let's try and extrapolate backwards on the basis of what the Mishnah says about this katan in the lulav.
Okay.
What did the Mishnah say? The Mishnah said that a katan can acquire...
So he can buy.
He can buy, but he can't sell.
Mm-hmm.
So what are we saying? We're saying that in a transaction,
a stupid person can
the katan, obviously,
sell.
We're assuming, has less clout.
Mm-hmm.
If the katan is the buyer, it works. If the katan is the seller, it doesn't work. So therefore we're saying that who's the major party? Extrapolate backwards.
The seller.
The seller.
Seller.
Right? So the halakha is assuming...
I lost your logic.
Okay, then I'll say it again. It's simple. The halakha says that katan, who obviously we're assuming has less clout than a gadol, if the katan is the buyer, it works. If the katan is the seller, it doesn't work. So if we're saying the katan was less clout, if he's the
less
seller,
authority.
It doesn't work. So it looks like his assumption is that the seller has to have a certain major level of legal clout. Otherwise, it doesn't work. So let's just do it. Okay, seller. So the katan, who has very little clout, what does it say? He can't pass it on. He can't sell. And therefore, it's not sold. But if the katan is the buyer, even though he has little clout, it works. Why? Because there's a seller who's a gadol. In other words, to say it in different language, as long as the seller is a gadol, it works.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, isn't it also implying that the seller has more control, like Mary said, over the item, and they're not giving, they're assuming the katan doesn't have that full
degree.
Capability,
right.
Knowledge,
right.
And therefore
right.
He's like you said, easily swindled in
right.
That.
It begins yeah. with the seller. So according to the halakha, it begins with the seller. So here you have a situation in the synagogue in which you have a gadol and he owns a lulav and he wants to sell it. He wants to pass it on to the katan, so the katan can do the mitzvah. Of course, the katan isn't obligated, but you want to give him the opportunity to learn. So you sell it to him. And that's possible because you, the gadol, are the seller and you can make him own it. He has enough legal authority to acquire. He doesn't have enough to sell, though. And therefore, when he wants to pass it on to someone else, the katan, he can't.
So he has to be the last in the line.
Yeah. And therefore, he has to be the last in the line. Everyone fulfills their obligation.
Which, by height.
Which,
and then
in
you
order
pass it on to the katan.
In order to make sure that he is indeed the last one, and that nobody else comes along that day on the first Yom Tov, needing...
Right, because then it's going to be too late.
So you just don't do it on the first Yom Tov because then you could have a potential problem.
Or you give him a gift to begin with, before the Yom Tov.
You buy him his own, you mean?
You buy him his own beforehand.
So now what we're saying is that the Katan can acquire, but he cannot
and sell.
Pass on. Why? Because of the reasons we've said. Now a riddle. According to this, we learn that according to the Tanakhama, the major opinion, as opposed to Rabbi Yossi, mm-hmm. we learned that a mitziah, a find of a katan, is only his because of Darkei Shalom, mm-hmm. only because of the ways of peace, it's a rabbinic enactment, but really, a mitziah is not his, a find is not his. Now I ask you, why is a find not his?
Well, a find's not something that he buys.
Right, because there's no seller.
Mm-hmm.
There's no seller. Even though we said a katan can acquire... Mm-hmm. But you can only acquire when someone else is selling, because it depends on the seller. Yeah,
with someone else with the authority to
right.
transfer
but when
ownership.
A Katan finds something, there's no one to transfer ownership to him. It all depends on his authority. He doesn't have the authority to acquire if no one else is selling, if no one's selling.
But what about your inheritance?
Inheritance, someone else is
that's
passing it on.
Right.
Even
if he's dead.
Yeah, because it's a legal contract. The will yeah. is a legal contract. Okay. So he can a katan can inherit, but he can't find, and he can buy, but he can't sell. That's the summation of the whole thing.
But if his find belongs to his father, then didn't he transfer ownership to his father?
It that's a social contract that we accept.
Oh, okay.
But when he finds it,
he's
it's as if his father found it.
As if his father.
Just like, for example, we have the concept in the laws of acquisition of chatzer. If you throw your diamond ring into my courtyard, then it's mine. Mm-hmm. It's not my hand. My property is part of my hand. The same thing with my son, as a social contract. It's not because the son is the not because the son can acquire it, but because the son is part of my possessions, and when it gets into his hand, it's if it's in my hand.
So it's not like a shaliach.
Shaliach has to be a legal entity, and the son is not a legal entity for finding. So anyway, therefore, back to our Mishnah, finally, mm-hmm. can a Heresh Shotev Katan own an ox? Of course,
yes.
Depending on how he got it. If he found it, it's not his. Mm-hmm. Right?
But you
and if a Katan sold it to him, it's not his.
It has to be a Gadol.
But if a Gadol sold it to a Katan...
Or he inherited
it. Or inherited it, then it could be his.
Right?
Then it could be his.
Right.
That's the upshot of the whole thing.
But if he found it, don't you have to Whoa. Treat it as if it's his?
Oh, you're right. Okay, that's a good point. According to the Halachah of Darkei Shalom, if he found it... I assume people just don't find oxen, but if he found it... then the Rabbanan, it would be his. Not the Raita, but the Rabbanan, it would be his.
What's the Rabbanan?
The Rabbanan, according to the rabbinic enactment, but not according to the Torah law. Okay. So, I now brought the Rambam, but there's no reason to read it, because the Rambam summarizes the things we've just said. And he summarizes it very well.
As always.
Mm-hmm. At the bottom of the page... We've read already the two sources at the bottom last time, mm-hmm. so we can skip those. And now we're at the top of the third page. And that top of the third page already brings us to the next part of our Mishnah, so let's go back and read the next part of the Mishnah, which means that we're back to the text. Mm. And now I'm debating with myself, should we try and finish the whole Mishnah today, or should we... No, let's not try. We'll just get to it. We get to it. We won't go over time. And we'll leave the rest for next time. So now we're in our Mishnah. Back to chapter 4, Mishnah 4. We read the first part, which was that lack of symmetry. That if my ox scores the Chershot of the Katan, I'm Chayav. But if his ox scores, then he's Patur. He's not legally responsible, even though he owns it. Right? He owns it, but he's not legally responsible. And then it says as follows: Shor shel cheresh shoteh v'katan shenagach beit din mamidin lehem apitropus umiidin lehem bifnei apitropus. Translation: the ox of a cheresh shoteh v'katan, that gourd, we already said in that case, he's not responsible. Mm-hmm. But now the Mishnah says, Beit Din Ma'midin Lehem Apitropos. The Beit Din, how do you say in English, Ma'midim?
Appoints.
Appoints for them an Apitropos, a guardian. Mm-hmm. It's a Greek word. Umi'idin Lehem Bifnei Apitropos. And the word mi'idin, of course, comes from the word aid, bear witness. Right. We bear witness for them in the presence of the apitropos, and in the context of Goring Shores, we know that this matter of bearing witness is about witnesses coming to say that the ox gored, and for what is that relevant? To change an ox from a tam to a muad. The muad comes from the word aid. That after three times that there were witnesses that it gored, it becomes now a mu'at. Mm-hmm. Now we have to ask ourselves, so what if it becomes a mu'at? We already said in the beginning of the Mishnah that the ox of the Heresh Shotev Katan doesn't pay.
But
now you're telling me that if his ox gored, we set up an apitropos, a guardian, and we bring witnesses in the presence of the apitropos, for what?
Well, the Muad rules overrule the first part of the Mishnah.
Perhaps that's the answer. Now, it's perhaps we're being told that if the ox gores one time when there's no apitropos, the Chershotev Katan doesn't pay anything. If the ox gored a second time, then we set up an apitropos. And then, if three times witnesses come and they bear witness in front of the apitropos and in front of the court, then the ox can become a muad.
What's
muad mean? A forewarned ox which has to pay full damage. So if that's the case, if that's the proper reading of the Mishnah, it would mean that the tam, the of a chershotev katan, never pays, but the ox could become a muad if an apitropos was appointed, and then we take from the possessions of the chershotev katan and pay full damage. The fourth time the ox scored.
Isn't it gzela?
What's that?
Stealing?
Well, it belongs to the Heresh Shotev Katan.
And it's ox scored.
But it's a bad ox.
Oh, okay.
But now we've declared it muad.
It's the pit bull.
It's the pit bull of oxes.
Yeah.
I don't know why you keep saying forewarned. Why don't you say mad or wild or
no? Because forewarned by the witnesses.
By the witnesses.
It was done in court.
Yeah.
But it's like forewarned the ox is not forewarned.
Well,
is it? No, but the people are.
The person responsible.
The people are. The person responsible.
Well, but if the person
is likely to gore again.
A mentally defective person. They're not capable of.
But there's an apitropos.
There's an apitropos that's responsible at that point. Okay.
I'm calling it forewarned because that's the word in Hebrew. Mu'ad literally means forewarned. Mu'ad, language of.
It's a word that kind of means, you know,
weakness.
I'm calling it what the Hebrew calls it.
Yeah, it's but the also person's forewarned.
Right, there's a point there. The fact that it happened three times.
Uh-huh.
You might understand it to be a statement about the ox.
It's a statement
but
about
you
the
might
person.
Understand it to be a statement about the person.
Right.
That the person by
the
now
ox.
Should know enough to be careful. And that's why it's called mu'ad.
Okay.
It's not so much the ox is mu'ad, the owner is mu'ad.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
it's like having a wild dog and you know, then you don't want to go near that dog.
Mm-hmm. You have to be careful.
Bitten, bitten.
Mm-hmm. So now there is one question we have to ask here.
Mm.
Normally, with a mu'ad, the fourth time it gores is when it has to pay full damage. The first three times, establish it as a mu'ad. The fourth time, you should have known better. Mm-hmm. Does that same arithmetic work here? Could you say that it doesn't? Could you say that four times is not enough?
Well, is there one time before they get the
exactly apitropos? Apitropos is a heretic. But Mary Beth said exactly right. Perhaps in this case it's not four times; it's five times.
Okay,
the first time, And then we appoint the apotropos three more times to warn it. And then the fifth time the one has to pay. That could be. Mm-hmm. Right? That's not clear.
But once the apotropos is appointed, is the second goring half paid or not?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah. That's a great, fantastic question.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So moves less times?
And I would think that the answer to the question from the pshat of the Mishnah is clear.
Yeah.
What's the answer?
No.
No, right. Mm-hmm. Because the Mishnah only says we appoint an apotropos for the purpose of mi'idim, for a forewarning. It doesn't say for the purpose of paying half damages a tam. So if we're reading the Mishnah correctly, that we appoint an apotropos, but when the ox now gores under the watchful guise of the apotropos, you don't have to pay anything until you get to Muad. Mm. That's probably what the Mishnah says, but we still ask, why? Why?
That village life will not be so good.
Yeah, there's an apotropos. Yeah. Why doesn't the ox have to pay at least half damage for the poor people who got gored? Why not? But the Mishnah seems to say it doesn't. Tosfot asks that question. So let's see some sources. Among them, Tosfot. Let's read the Tosfot first, since that was brought up by Ilana. The Tosfot is the third source on the top of the third side. Mm-hmm. Right? Third source. It says, Tosfot Masechet Baba Kama Daf Lamed Tet. You have it, Vivian?
Yes.
Yeah.
Tosfot. So, Tosfot quotes from a statement in the Gemara that we didn't read, and the statement is Ein mamidin apitropus latam ligabot migufo. Ligbot migufo. We don't, what word did you use in English for mamidim? Appoint. We don't appoint an apitropus for a tam to collect from its body. Remember, a tam collects from the body only up to the value of the body of the ox, whereas a muad collects up to the roof. Very good.
What's a tam?
A tam is an unforewarned ox. It has to pay only half nezik, half damage. So Tosfot quotes from a statement in the Gemara that we don't appoint an apotropos to make it a tam to pay half. We only appoint the apotropos for it to become a muad. As Ilana asked and figured out. Okay? So says Tosfot, tema. Tema means I'm surprised. My tam, Dain Mamidin. What's the reason we don't appoint? Why don't we appoint an apotropos even for the purpose of having the tam pay half nezik? Why not? It's not fair. And I have there three dots, which means I skip lots and lots and lots and lots of potential answers that Tosfot tries and discards until he says, Vav Yud Lamid, an abbreviation, V'yesh Lomar. And there is to say, V'yesh Lomar, the hatamhu, that the reason is kevan de has rachmana alatam, since the Torah had mercy upon the tam, shelo yishalem nezek shalem, that it does not have to pay full damage, hilkach legebe yatme hashu alayhu, therefore as far as orphans they had mercy upon them, Akilu Bei Rabbanan, and we're lenient, the rabbis.
Rachmana is God, no?
It means the Torah.
Really?
You call it God. It's relates to our class this morning. The Talmud seems to equate God in the Torah, which is exactly what the Mea Shiloach this morning was talking about. Another story. So anyway, Tosfot says, I really have no answer, just the rabbis were nice guys to the poor orphans. And they took a hint from the Torah. Since in the Torah, a discount is given for a tam, and let's pay chatzin nezek. So the rabbi said, look, orphans are really in trouble, and the Torah is anyway giving discounts for tam, so we'll give a discount to the tam of an orphan, and we won't have him pay at all, even if there's an apotropos. So the end answer is, the Tosfot says, I don't have a good reason. It's just rachmanut.
Rachmana
litzlan
is the Torah one?
Look, leave me alone. you're right, it means God. But in yeshiva,
they say the Torah.
We say Torah. We leave God out of it. Okay, so anyway, this is where we're going to stop. And next week we'll examine two questions on this matter. Is it really true that even if there's an apitropos, the tam of the Cheresh Shoteh V'Katan doesn't pay? We'll see different opinions against Tosfot's understanding of the Gemara. And then we'll talk about how many times does the animal have to gore for it to become a muad? Does the time when it gored before the apitropos count? Or do we start again?
Mm-hmm. And don't we have also an issue of frequency?
That's standard for all types of muad. Okay.
Right.
Stay tuned. Right.
Stay tuned.
And watch your oxen.
Right. Okay. Well, we saw cows.
I'm so glad none of my neighbors.
Oxen.